Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
Today is my mom's 80th birthday, which is impossible that she's 80, but happy birthday, Mom. In your own family, your mom's birthday, particularly if it's a big round number, birthday probably feels like the biggest holiday there is. But we do have federal holidays in the United States that we celebrate regardless of my mom's birthday. There are not very many of them. There's Thanksgiving, there's Christmas, New Year's Day, there's Veterans Day in November, Memorial Day in May, Labor Day in September, we have Martin Luther King Day in January, Columbus Day in October, President's Day in February. That's nine, I think. And of course, there's the 10th one, 4th of July. That's the easiest one to remember because we call it the 4th of July. And every year it's in July on the 4th, reliably. If you are a person who is bad with dates like I am, even about family birthdays, that's a particular blessing about July 4th. I feel the same way about Cinco de Mayo, frankly. Anybody that tells me in the name of the holiday when the holiday is, I thank you. But tonight, the House of Representatives voted to create the newest federal holiday, and we do not do this that often as a country. It has been nearly 40 years since the last new federal holiday was formally recognized with the approval of the holiday honoring the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That was way back in 1983. Tonight, though, we have just done it for the first time since then. Again, almost 40 years. There was a unanimous vote in the Senate that we told you about on last night's show that happened late yesterday. Now, tonight, there's been a big but not unanimous vote in the House. But it passed easily. And in the end, it was Texas Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee who was able to call it with just palpable joy as she did so.
On this vote, the yeas are 415 and the nays are 14. The bill is passed.
Texas Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee announcing the passage tonight in the House of legislation to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee sponsored the legislation to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. She also sponsored legislation to create what they call a national emancipation trail to trace the news of the Emancipation Proclamation, the news of the freeing of the slaves to Galveston, Texas. It took more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by President Lincoln for the news to reach Galveston on June 19th, 1865. Once President Biden signs this bill that has now passed the Senate and the House, June 19th every year will be celebrated as the Juneteenth federal holiday, honoring the end of slavery in the United States. And like I said, it was a unanimous vote in the Senate. It was an overwhelming vote in the House, but not a unanimous one. There were 14 Republicans who voted against it. 14 conservative Republican white guys all voted that we should not commemorate the end of slavery in the United States, which is the kind of vote that will stick to their shoe forever and smell up any room they ever walk into for the rest of their lives. Forgive me for saying so. But, you know, it's worth noting that they were a rump minority. Yes, there were 14 Republican men who voted no, but there were 195 Republican men and women who voted yes for the holiday, along with every single Democrat in the United States House and every single United States senator from both parties. So take Congresswoman Lee's palpable joy as the punctuation mark on this vote today. President Biden is on his way back from Europe as we speak. There is no rule that says he has to sign this newly passed bill as soon as he gets back. But there is some good timing coming up that would seem to indicate that he has reason to hurry. Juneteenth is Saturday. Today's Wednesday, the 16th. The 19th is this weekend. So if he signs this new law, this new bill into law on Saturday or before, this year, 2021, will be the first year that we as a nation commemorate that day as a federal holiday. We will commemorate it together as a country, even including the 14 Republican men who voted against it. It will be a holiday in their country, too, even if they don't like it. So we will see about the timing on when it gets signed into law, but this is a big deal. It's a big vote tonight. It is a big thing for our country and for our history. It'll also indelibly shine a nice, bright spotlight on the 14 Republican men who stood against it. Hi, guys. I hope you enjoy this week. I hope you enjoy your weekend. Hope you enjoy this weekend in particular a lot. Today at their summit in Geneva, Switzerland, President Biden and President Vladimir Putin agreed that the U.S. ambassador to Russia and the Russian ambassador to the U.S., they can go back home. They can go back to their respective embassies. The Russian ambassador can go back to the U.S. embassy in Washington. The U.S. ambassador can go back to the American embassy in Moscow. Both of those ambassadors have been staying away since one of the recent rounds of U.S. sanctions on the Russian government for them messing with our elections and for them poisoning and trying to kill Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. At their summit today, President Biden and President Putin also agreed to further dialogue between our two governments on a few important matters, including cyber attacks, also on what they call strategic stability. Which sounds like nothing, right? Or at least it sounds like something you might do on like a wobbly little platform at the gym. I mean, strategic stability, what does that even mean? In end of the world terms, what that means is that they're going to talk about neither side having new nuclear weapons of some kind that don't have an equivalent on the other side. Because it's perceived to be unstable for one of our two countries to have the ability to wipe the other one off the map in a way that the other country couldn't theoretically reciprocate. Seriously, that's the insanity of nuclear weapons thinking. Sure, 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 the world will end, but it will end equally. Because anything else is unstable. Yeah, but both sides having the ability to destroy each other and the whole world several times over, that's stable. That's very stable. That's a nice equipoise we can all live with comfortably, assuming there's no accidents. That's what they mean when they say strategic stability. It's the most anodyne, problem-sounding term, and it is about the exact way we want to approach the end of the world as potentially effectuated by our two countries mutually, rather than in some unbalanced way. That's strategic stability. Our countries will open a new dialogue about strategic stability. The people who know these things say that's good. The people who know these things that well, however, also have scary minds because they've got to think about this stuff all the time. President Biden, at his press conference after the meeting, he seems sort of, I mean, your mileage may vary depending on how you perceive the president, may affect how you saw him today. To me, he seems sort of grounded and satisfied with how it went. President Biden said he believed it was important for he and President Putin to meet in person. He said, quote, I did what I came to do. He said the tone of the discussion with Putin was good and positive. He described it as neither strident nor hyperbolic and said that's important. That's the way it needs to be. If you had the sense, though, that this means we're friends now, we're not friends now. President Biden both took pains to say that no threats were issued by either side in today's discussions. But then he also made sure to share with the press this not very subtle threat that he says he left in Putin's proverbial lap.
And before I take your questions, I want to say one last thing. Folks, look, this is about how we move from here. I listened to, again, a significant portion of what President Putin's press conference was. And as he pointed out, this is about practical, straightforward, no-nonsense decisions that we have to make or not make. For example, when I talked about the pipeline that cyber hit for $5 million, that ransomware hit in the United States, I looked at him and I said, well, how would you feel? if ransomware took on the pipelines from your oil fields? He said it would matter. This is not about just our self-interest. It's about a mutual self-interest. I'll take your questions.
And then he took questions. I looked at him and I said, well, how would you feel about a cyber attack taking down the pipelines from your oil fields, President Putin? According to President Biden, he said it would matter. Yeah, you've got your Russian cyber attack shutting down our fuel pipeline on the East Coast. You're the physically the largest country on Earth with an economy smaller than Italy's, in part because your government is terrible and also because there is no Russian economy other than oil. But because of your corruption and your terrible governance, even your oil sector, the entire basis of your economy, is backward and decrepit. You think cyber attacks on us are no big deal? Cyber attacks on our fuel infrastructure is no big deal, really? You want to put yourself on the line here, too?
I pointed out, Tim, we have significant cyber capability. And he knows it. He doesn't know exactly what it is, but it's significant. And if, in fact, they violate his basic norms, we will respond. Cyber. He knows.
He knows. President Putin, for his part today, he denied all Russian responsibility for any cyber attacks on the United States at all. Also for the attacks his government mounted against our elections in 2016 and 2020. But President Putin seemed to squirm the hardest under questioning from U.S. reporters. He was asked multiple times, for example, about Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader who was very nearly assassinated with a Russian military-grade nerve agent, and who Putin has had in prison ever since Navalny survived that poisoning attempt and then came back to Russia. President Putin said today that Alexei Navalny is only in prison because he, quote, consciously chose not to check in person with Russian security services while he was out of the country being treated for that poisoning. Putin actually used the word consciously. Alexei Navalny was literally unconscious at the time. He was in a coma because Russian security agents dosed him with a military-grade nerve agent. So he wasn't exactly making conscious decisions about anything, let alone making a conscious decision to not check in with Russian security services while he laid in a coma in Germany fighting for his life because Russian security people tried to kill him with a military-grade nerve agent from the Russian military. Yeah, he didn't think to check in. I'm not sure if Vladimir Putin knows that he gave a laughingstock answer there, because in Russia, I think nobody gets caught laughing at him. But really, consciously, that's the word you're choosing? ABC News reporter Rachel Scott pressed him on Navalny today and on related matters. The exchange, actually, between reporter Rachel Scott and President Putin, to my eye, was the moment that was probably the most important public exchange of the whole day.
If I may, sir, the list of your political opponents who are dead, prisoned, or jailed is long. Alexei Navalny's organization calls for free and fair elections, an end to corruption, but Russia has outlawed that organization, calling it extremist, and you have now prevented anyone who supports him to run for office. So my question is, Mr. President, what are you so afraid of?
It's not prohibited. They're not prohibited from working. They can continue to operate. Foreign agents don't need to stop operating. If they are extremist in nature, then that's another issue. The organization that you mentioned has publicly called for a mass disorder.
You didn't answer my question, sir. If all of your political opponents are dead, in prison, poisoned, doesn't that send a message that you do not want a fair political fight?
As for who is killing whom or throwing whom in jail, people came to the U.S. Congress with political demands. 400 people. Over 400 people had criminal charges placed on them.
ABC News congressional correspondent Rachel Scott driving Vladimir Putin to sputtering today, flummoxing him to the point where he started going, oh, what about January 6th? What about that? What about? President Putin actually repeatedly brought up today the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, essentially implying that he was on the side of the Trump supporters who thought that day that they could reverse the presidential election result by force with a violent attack on the Capitol to stop the certifying of the election result. It's a remarkable thing to see from him. Not long after Biden and Putin's press conferences wrapped up in Geneva, the Washington Post broke this very interesting news story about the days leading up to the January 6th attack and how President Trump actually made some progress in those days in trying to get the U.S. Justice Department to act on his behalf, to flip the election result or otherwise stop the election results from being made official. The Post story is based on those bombshell emails that were released by the House Oversight Committee yesterday, which we reported on here last night on the show. But they also supplemented the source material with interviews with people who were involved in or who were briefed on those events in those fraught three or so weeks after the election, and in the immediate days leading up to the U.S. Capitol attack. As we reported last night, Justice Department officials were not passive in their response when Trump and his White House chief of staff and Trump allies, acting on the president's behalf, tried to get the U.S. Justice Department to take action based on these moonbat wingnut claims that it must have been election fraud in the states that Joe Biden won. The Post notes in its new reporting tonight, quote, the department did examine some of the claims from Trump, and top Justice Department officials forwarded some of the material from Trump allies to U.S. attorneys in Michigan and Pennsylvania. In other words, as we reported last night, they did not passively receive it and make sure the pressure from the White House went no further than them, top officials in the Justice Department. They actually passed it down to prosecutors in the relevant states. Now, when it comes to Georgia, there's very interesting new reporting here from The Washington Post. Quote, one relatively high-ranking Justice Department lawyer, a man named Jeffrey Clark, seemed to entertain Trump's requests, pushing internally to have the Justice Department assert that fraud in the state of Georgia was the cause for that state's lawmaker, to disregard Georgia's election results and appoint new presidential electors. Trump contemplated installing Jeff Clark as attorney general. Clark was then running both the Environment and Natural Resources Division and also the Civil Division at the Justice Department. And he, unlike others in the Justice Department, was more sympathetic to Trump's claims of election fraud. According to people familiar with the matter, Jeff Clark became particularly focused on Georgia, trying to persuade Justice Department leaders that they should issue a letter that argued that Georgia's elections were affected by fraud and, as a consequence, Georgia's lawmakers should disregard the presidential election results and instead appoint their own electors, meaning have the Republicans in the state legislature pick Trump electors instead of the state's electors who were for Biden because Biden actually won the state. According to two people familiar with the matter, Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen tried to convince Jeff Clark that his theories were misguided. On New Year's Day, he shared with Jeff Clark the cell phone number of BJ Pack, who was then the U.S. attorney, the top federal prosecutor in Atlanta. Two people familiar with the matter said that Rosen was helpful, that the U.S. attorney could convince Jeff Clark there was no widespread fraud in Georgia. After giving Jeff Clark the U.S. attorney's phone number, Rosen circled back the next day, asking Clark in an email, were you able to follow up? In a meeting at the White House 2 days later, January 3rd, according to two people familiar with the matter, President Trump complained that he wanted to fire the Georgia U.S. attorney, BJ Pack, who he felt was not doing enough to uncover fraud in Georgia. The people said participants in the meeting told the president that BJ Pack intended to leave anyway, that he need not take the step of firing him. Just after 10 p.m. that night, an email shows a senior Justice Department official named Richard Donahue emailed the U.S. attorney, emailed BJ Pack, writing in the subject line, please call ASAP. Two people familiar with the matter said the official conveyed to BJ Pack what was said at the meeting about him. Early the next morning, Pack informed staff he was stepping down. He was then replaced by a new U.S. attorney, a man named Bobby Christine, whom Trump viewed as more amenable to his voter fraud claims. This is the fullest accounting we have yet had of that incident. The president pushing these bogus election fraud claims in Georgia because he does not want to have lost Georgia. He's threatening Georgia officials, right? We now know, telling them they needed to find enough votes to declare him the winner. He's got a guy he's trying to install as the new attorney general, planning to install as the new attorney general, who wants the Justice Department to, in fact, write to Georgia and tell them they can't certify their results. They need their election results were infected with fraud and new electors should be appointed. The U.S. attorney, the top federal prosecutor in Georgia, got calls from Main Justice by that official, who wanted to tell Georgia officially from the Justice Department that Georgia needed to uncertify their election and instead say Trump won. The U.S. attorney, after receiving that call and getting a follow-up call from the White House, resigns under circumstances still not clear. There is an active criminal investigation underway in the state of Georgia into the president's actions when he tried to interject himself into the process, tried to influence elections officials to try to get them to alter the election outcome in that state. It's being investigated by multiple congressional committees and by the Justice Department Inspector General. It is also being investigated as a criminal matter by a state prosecutor in the state of Georgia. What was said to that U.S. attorney who resigned? What was said to him by the Justice Department official who called him up, the one we know wanted Georgia to undo its election results? What was said to him in the call from the White House? Why did he resign? What did they try to get him to do? And this is starting to look like a pretty good map of the potential crime scene for an ongoing criminal investigation. Joining us now is Amy Gardner. She's the Washington Post national political reporter. She's one of four Post reporters who's bylined on this story today. Ms. Gardner, it's really nice to have you here. Thanks for making time tonight.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
So this piece today is a great sort of connecting of the dots and a bringing together of lots of different sources of information, including interviews with people involved in or briefed on these events. In terms of the pressure that was put on Justice Department officials, what are the unanswered questions here? What are the black boxes that aren't answered either in the emails or in the interviews that you and your colleagues conducted that either a criminal investigation or congressional investigation might be able to get at?
Well, I can tell you what I'm really curious about. I'm certainly curious about exactly what prompted BJ Pack to resign, as you just alluded to. I think that there are a couple of different possibilities, and we just don't know what happened. It seems as if Rich Donahue called him to say that Trump was displeased with him and that that conversation prompted Mr. Pack to resign. That doesn't mean that Pack was asked to do something that he didn't want to do. It could mean that he saw, this is a man who was planning to resign anyway, had already announced his plans to resign. He saw that he was going to be a distraction in the efforts in Maine Justice to sort of fend off President Trump's efforts to overturn the election. So we just don't know exactly what happened there. The other thing that I'm really curious about is you talked about Jeff Clark, the assistant attorney general over environment and civil, who was more eager than some of the other leadership at DOJ to help President Trump find evidence of fraud. Well, what was the evidence that he was pursuing and who was he talking to seek out that evidence? There's one exchange in the emails that we got yesterday where he talks about the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, says, did you talk to BJ Pack? And we know from our reporting that he wanted Mr. Pack to explain to Mr. Clark that there wasn't widespread fraud in Georgia, that he should back off, that this was a fool's errand. But instead, Mr. Clark responds to Rosen in this email, no, I didn't talk to Pack. He says, I spoke to the source. I'm on with the guy who took the video right now, working on it, more due diligence to do. We have no idea what he's talking about here. What video? What guy? I mean, there were videos shot, as we all know, of election workers and, you know, voting equipment contractors doing their jobs that were wildly misinterpreted by conspiracy theorists. People had death threats. There was a noose hung in the front lawn of one worker for Dominion Voting in Georgia. Was he speaking to somebody who took videos like that, who in some cases had, you know, relationships with QAnon? Was the, you know, a senior leader in the DOJ going to people with QAnon relationships to find evidence of fraud in the 2020 election? I mean, that's my biggest question that I don't know the answer to right now.
And Amy, we also know from these emails, as you guys point out in your reporting tonight, that some of these complaints from President Trump and his allied forces were actually sent down the line to U.S. attorneys in both the Eastern and Western districts of Michigan, and also to a U.S. attorney in the Western District of Pennsylvania. From my read through those emails, there's very little indication of what, if anything, came of those communications. I think those, from my read about the way these emails are being received and what we're learning, I'm not sure that anybody's as head up about this as I am. I find it very concerning that senior officials at Maine Justice are putting this stuff down the line to federal prosecutors rather than sitting on it themselves and absorbing the pressure themselves. By passing it on from Maine Justice to actual U.S. attorneys in the field, it would seem like that's an important act of furtherance toward what the president was trying to accomplish. But do we know anything about how those materials were received, either in Michigan or in Pennsylvania?
I have a slightly different take on that. I think that there was some protection going on by senior leaders in Maine Justice in regards to the U.S. attorneys out in the field. I think that they were trying to signal to the White House that they were listening and doing what they were being asked to do. But you can see in those emails, you know, there'll be a note that says, please take a look at this for what it's worth. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it in front of me. But, you know, there's a phrase like for what it's worth. I also had one conversation with a former Justice Department official who told me that if the leadership of Maine Justice wants a U.S. attorney to run something down to the ground, it's a phone call. It's not an email. And I also learned that these sort of tips or conspiracy theories or whatever you want to call them were investigated. And the fact that we never learned of anything, that we never learned of, you know, charges, grand juries being, you know, asked to, you know, indict is actually evidence that they were investigated and alternate explanations for what was being alleged were discovered. So I do think that there was a little bit of a nuanced sort of strategy on the part of the senior leadership at Justice to not, you know, slam the door in the face of the White House officials who were emailing them, including Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, but while also sort of slow walking what they were doing internally to make sure that this didn't go too far.
Yeah, at least until one U.S. attorney through this process found himself enough in the crosshairs that the president was sounding off at meetings about wanting to fire him. He got that communicated to him, apparently, from that meeting. And within a few hours, he was out. I mean, at least one of them, it cost him his job. Boy, do I want to know more of those circumstances. We'll get them in time. Amy Gardner is Washington Post political reporter. Congratulations to you and your colleagues on this important advance in this story. Thanks for helping us understand it.
Thank you, Rachel.
All right. We've got much more ahead here tonight. Busy news night. Stay with us.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
When Russian President Vladimir Putin held his post-summit press conference in Geneva earlier today, the room was packed with journalists and also with translators. President Putin actually does speak English, but he makes a habit of not doing so in public. So non-Russian-speaking reporters needed to have their questions to him translated into Russian. But at least one reporter there for the Wall Street Journal today, she did not need her question translated into Russian. She needed it translated for her colleagues in the press pool into English.
Mr. President, thank you very much for affording me the opportunity to ask you a question. A few years ago, you met President Biden. That was when he was vice president. What he said was that he looked you in the eye, and he said that he didn't see a soul. And you said, that means we understand one another. Did you, tell me please, did you look him in the eye, and what did you see there? Did you see a person with whom you can work?
That was Ann Simmons, Wall Street Journal's Moscow bureau chief, obviously fluent in Russian, asking President Putin to recall his meeting 10 years ago with then Vice President Biden, when Biden reportedly said to him, Mr. Prime Minister, I'm looking into your eyes and I don't think you have a soul. Here's part of what Putin said in response to Ms. Simmons' question today.
As for the soul, seeing it or not seeing something, well, this isn't the first time I've heard this. Frankly speaking, I don't recall this conversation, but I will allow that it happened and it escaped my attention. But if you ask me, what sort of a partner, what sort of a conversational partner Biden is, I'd say he's very constructive, he's very balanced, just the way that I expected. He's very experienced. You can tell that at first glance. And what I think is...
Joining us now from Geneva is the reporter who asked President Putin that question, eliciting that sort of remarkable response from him about how it isn't the first time he's heard about people looking at him and wondering if he had a soul. Ann Simmons is the Wall Street Journal Moscow bureau chief. Ms. Simmons, it's a real pleasure to have you here tonight. I know it's been a very long day. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Mr. Putin went on in his answer to you to conclude effectively by saying that this was not a relationship where he and the president of the United States needed to like each other. This is a pragmatic relationship in which they both needed to represent their countries. Just wanted to get your take on whether that was a satisfying answer and whether you think he was telling you the full truth there.
Well, I think the Russians came into this, and in particular Mr. Putin, really not wanting to create any kind of conflict, and that was from both sides. So there was kind of a tempering of the tensions that we have noticed in recent days. And so Mr. Putin was very much in the mode of, I'm not going to kind of rock the boat here, I'm going to be a little bit complimentary, which he was. But that's not to say that tensions still do not exist. There were many areas where both of these presidents, both Washington and Moscow, still do not agree. And that certainly came out as well during the course of their talks.
As somebody who is fluent in Russian, was able to ask that question of President Putin today in Russian, I particularly wanted to talk to you tonight, Anne, to ask you about what seemed in translation to be a troubling or unsettling word choice by President Putin when he was asked one of several questions he faced about Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader in Russia who's now in jail, who narrowly survived an assassination attempt. He described Navalny as having consciously chosen to break Russian law when he was treated and after that assassination attempt in Germany. And because he was in Germany and part of that time in a coma, he missed meetings with Russian security services who he was supposed to check in with. That consciously word from him, I think, threw everybody back in their chairs in translation. Did it have a different meaning in Russian?
No, I mean, he really did want to make the point that Mr. Navalny knew that he would be in trouble if he came back to Russia. Mr. Navalny, according to Mr. Putin, knew that he had broken the rules, he had violated Russian law, and that if he returned, he would be in hot water. So very much so, he was making the point that Mr. Navalny has gotten what he deserves. He's making the point, basically, that Mr. Navalny would not be in prison now if he had not come back to Russia. But he came back, consciously made the decision to return.
Do you think that President Putin and his government might have been surprised today by the repeated questioning about Mr. Navalny? Obviously, President Biden said that he pressed him on it and referred to that several times. But to get repeated questions and at times aggressive questioning about the treatment of Navalny, would that have been something they expected? Or do you think that might have been more than they were bargaining for?
I think they absolutely expected to get questions about Mr. Navalny because the foreign press, at least the foreign media in Russia, have been quite aggressive, quite assertive in asking questions of the Kremlin about this opposition leader. I don't think it came as a surprise at all. I believe that Mr. Putin was probably thinking, if I don't hear a question about Mr. Navalny, that would be the surprise. So certainly, Mr. Putin never mentions Mr. Navalny by name, as you know. He always says when he was in Germany, he referred to him as being the Berlin patient. And right now, he will mention the person in prison or the person detained. He never mentions his name. But that certainly the question came up, do you fear Mr. Navalny? And Mr. Putin has kind of skirted answering that question. But in the past, he has definitely said, of course, I do not.
Ann Simmons, Wall Street Journal, Moscow bureau chief. It has been a full 24-hour day for you today already, at minimum. Thank you for staying up with us so late, and thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you so much.
All right, we've got more ahead tonight. Stay with us.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
When Michael McFaul was tapped by President Obama to be the U.S. ambassador to Russia, President Putin and his government decided that they would make Michael McFaul a boogeyman. McFaul details the whole thing in a book that he wrote called From Cold War to Hot Peace. In the book, he explains that basically as soon as he was named to be the U.S. ambassador, state-run Russian TV started denouncing him, saying he had no business being an ambassador, that he was some kind of operative who was an expert in destabilizing governments and starting revolutions. They also denounced him, tellingly, as a really, really, really close friend of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Now, Michael McFaul at that point had met Alexei Navalny precisely once. And while Ambassador McFaul is a very nice guy who makes fast friends, he's not that fast. As ambassador to Russia, not only did Mr. McFaul continue to meet with Russian opposition leaders and independent media, he went out of his way to be seen doing it as a sort of unbowed message about the U.S. government's support for democracy and for free expression and for a free press in the United States, in Russia, all over the world. And Russian state media treated that like it was the crime of the century. They would do stakeouts and release video montages of every Russian political figure and an independent journalist who ever visited the U.S. embassy. They put the footage up on screen over titles like obtaining instructions from the U.S. embassy, like they'd caught these people being spies or traitors. President Biden's summit meeting with President Putin today was, of course, behind closed doors. But when talking to the press afterwards, President Biden spoke at length about how much discussions of Russian opposition leaders like Alexei Navalny and independent media outlets like Radio Free Europe were at the core of his conversations today with President Putin. He even went out of his way to take a question from a Radio Free Europe reporter. What will the consequences of that be? What will that mean for Russian opposition leaders and independent media outlets in Russia to have an American president standing up for them so bluntly and confronting President Putin so bluntly over his fear of opposition and his fear of a free press. We know from experience it's the kind of thing that drives the Kremlin nuts. What will happen inside Russia as a consequence of how President Biden pushed those issues today? I feel like nobody's in a better position to talk about that than our former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. I should also note he was involved in briefing President Biden before this summit today. Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia under President Obama, joins us live now. Mr. Ambassador, it's great to see you. Thank you for staying up till the middle of nowhere, the middle of the night to be with us tonight.
Glad to be with you, as always, Rachel.
What are likely to be the consequences, if any, of today's events for Russian opposition figures, for independent media in Russia? It feels like the Kremlin has felt untrammeled, totally unconstrained in the way that it's been going after the opposition and the media lately. What will today do to affect that, if anything?
Well, first, you're absolutely right. 2021 will go down in Russian history as one of the most autocratic years we've had since the collapse of the Soviet Union. In fact, I think you have to go deep into the Soviet Union to remember a time that has been so oppressive. And so I was delighted, I have to say honestly, to hear the President of the United States again talk about democracy and human rights like traditionally we used to. But it was very important, I think, what President Biden said today. And he named Navalny. He didn't shy away from him. I don't know if you remember, but our previous president wouldn't use his name either, just like Vladimir Putin. And I can tell you, I spoke to some Navalny supporters after that press conference. They heard that voice of support. It doesn't mean things are going to change overnight, but it does mean that they are hearing that people who believe in democracy outside of their own country are thinking about them. And there's a kind of feeling of solidarity, I would say, about ideas that are shared between Russians and Americans.
In terms of how things went today, what you know about how the closed-door meetings went and what we all saw in terms of the press conferences, do you have any regrets or worries or things that you really wish had gone a different way?
You know, once they set the meeting, that put a lot of pressure on President Biden and his team. You know, we're all here. I'm here in Geneva because we want to cover this summit. Even the word summit is a dangerous word in my view. But once the meeting was set, I think it was orchestrated pretty well, actually incredibly well. The buildup was right. Meet with your Democratic allies first in a series of meetings. Come here. The orchestration in terms of the protocol was perfect. Biden showed up second. That's important. There were note takers in the room. That's important. And they didn't do a joint press conference. That was fantastic. By the way, fantastic because great journalists like Ann Simmons got to ask President Putin some pretty tough questions. That would not have happened had there been a joint presser with just two or three questions on each side. So that was good. And I would say on the substance, let's be honest, there was not that much accomplished. Baby steps towards strategic stability talks, sending our ambassadors back. But remember, Putin was the one who removed his ambassador. He's just restoring him on his own. We didn't have anything to do with that. But it was important. You need to engage with Putin. I think that's right. And now they have to go home and do their homework to have a strategy of containing Putin as well.
Mr. McFaul, do you believe that it is of significance either domestically in Russia or domestically in the United States that Putin keeps bringing up January 6th as if the people who attacked the U.S. Capitol to try to stop the certifying of the election, as if those people are should be seen as political prisoners or that Russia's on their side in some way? Is this just a diversion, a sort of deliberate verbal provocation, or do you see that as potentially consequential either there or here?
For me, Rachel, it was the worst moment of Mr. Putin's press conference today to compare the peaceful organization that Mr. Navalny heads, which is fighting corruption, with those that use violence to storm our capital. One side is fighting peacefully for democracy. The other side is doing the exact opposite. that's classic Putin whataboutism, but here's another dimension. He's siding with Mr. Trump and the people that support Mr. Trump. And I think people forget that, yes, there is a battle between democratic states and autocratic states. The president rightly spoke about that today and throughout this trip. But there's also a battle within states between Democrats and autocrats. There's a fight going on in Russia, and there's also a fight going on in the United States of America, and, by the way, in other European countries as well. And that's the kind of linkage. Putin thinks he's fighting an ideological battle. He's doing that on purpose to rally supporters, and tragically, it's having some success in Europe and in the United States as well.
Michael McFaul, who was U.S. ambassador to Russia under President Obama, who helped prepare President Biden for this meeting today with President Putin. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for your time tonight, particularly given the very late hour and how long a day this has been. Thanks very much.
I'll always get up or stay up for you, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
You're very kind. All right, we'll be right back. Stay with us. This was interesting today on voting rights. There's only one Democrat in the Senate who isn't co-sponsoring the big voting rights bill, the Senate Bill 1, the For the People Act. 49 of 50 Democratic senators are on board with it, but not Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Earlier this month, he, of course, published an op-ed saying he wouldn't vote for it. If no Republicans would vote for it, then neither would he. The Senate Republican leader has said, in fact, not a single Republican will vote for a voting rights bill. So that would seem to be the end of that. But then today, interesting news. Senator Manchin today released a list, what he called a compromise proposal on voting rights, a list of things that he likes and that he apparently thinks could get lots of Republican support. He then noisily held a meeting with eight Republican senators to discuss his proposal on voting rights. The problem here, though, is the math. Say, for argument's sake, that all the other Democrats give Joe Manchin everything he wants on this bill. They all agree to still vote for it, even though there's a bunch of stuff in there that Democrats don't like. And say that Manchin miraculously convinces all eight of these Republican senators he's meeting with that they should also support the bill. That would still not be enough votes to pass it over a Republican filibuster, even under the unrealistically auspicious circumstances I just described, unless Senator Manchin is willing to change the Senate rules so that at least voting rights bills can't be filibustered. He's proposing this compromise for absolutely nothing. Senator Manchin says he wants to pass a voting rights bill. The math doesn't work, though, and the coverage of this should reflect that. Watch this space. That is going to do it for us tonight. I will see you again right here tomorrow night.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.